From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am extremely happy of being able to go back to my homeland, and I don't have words, really, to express what I feel.
We are happy to go home, the last public words of Juan Miguel Gonzalez as he took his son home to Cuba. Today we go to Havana for reaction, and Manning Marable speaks to the Greens. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The funeral for Shaka Sankofa, formerly known as Gary Graham, is being held today in Houston. Nearly 3,000 people, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson, came to a memorial service yesterday for the man executed by the state last Thursday. Shaka Sankofa became an icon for capital punishment opponents who argued he was wrongfully convicted by the testimony of a single eyewitness. There were two other eyewitnesses whose testimony was never heard at trial. Opponents of the death penalty also pointed out he was poorly represented by an incompetent lawyer. And several high court rulings. A sharply divided Supreme Court ruled yesterday the First Amendment protected the Boy Scouts' right to oust a scout leader because he is homosexual. In a bitter 5-4 decision, the court found the Boy Scouts' right of free speech as an expressive association trumps a state civil rights statute. The ruling came in a case involving New Jersey's enforcement of its anti-discrimination law against the Monmouth County, New Jersey Boy Scouts Council. The court ruled the council had properly discharged James Dale as an assistant scoutmaster in 1990 after learning he was gay. Chief Justice William Rehnquist, writing for the majority, said the fact of Dale's homosexuality was sufficient grounds for a private organization like the Boy Scouts to dismiss him because it conflicted with the, quote, morally straight and clean message scouting tries to convey. In a bitter dissent, Justice John Paul Stevens called the decision odd, far-fetched, and mind-boggling. The Supreme Court also ruled by a 5-4 vote yesterday that the government cannot prohibit doctors from performing a procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion because it may be the most medically appropriate way of terminating some pregnancies. The decision declared unconstitutional the Nebraska law before the court and, in effect, the laws of 30 other states. In addition, the bill to create a federal ban on the procedure, which President Clinton has vetoed twice and which may reach his desk again this year, would also be unconstitutional under the court's analysis. Protesters outside women's health clinics may also face some new restrictions because of a Supreme Court ruling. The court is giving states greater leeway to restrict those protests. In a 6-3 vote, the justices upheld a 93 law that keeps people from counseling, distributing leaflets, or displaying signs within 8 feet of others without their consent whenever they're within 100 feet of a clinic entrance. A huge wildfire that roared across the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington state was burning out of control early today in the arid sagebrush country of southern Washington. At least 25 homes have been destroyed and thousands of people were urged to evacuate. The fire exploded late yesterday, doubling in size to 100,000 acres as it closed highways and briefly threatened a Hanford building holding radioactive waste. It later jumped the Yakima River and began burning homes near Benton City, about 10 miles west of Richland. The flames, fueled by 100-degree temperatures and winds gusting to 30 miles per hour, overwhelmed about 350 firefighters yesterday. About 600 more from across the region are expected to arrive soon, aided by airplanes and helicopters from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And this news from Tokyo. A nuclear power plant in northwestern Japan is being shut down because of a cooling water leak. The government says only a small amount of water was released, and they said no radiation leaked outside the plant. The split in a once-united front on smoking and health has widened with testimony from the last of five tobacco executives whose companies are fighting punitive damages in a landmark smokers' lawsuit. Martin Orlovsky, the chief executive of Lorillard Tobacco Company, said publicly for the first time that his company, the fourth largest cigarette maker, believes smoking is addictive and causes lung cancer and other diseases. His testimony yesterday was similar to that of Brown & Williamson Tobacco CEO Nicholas Brooks, but does not go as far as Liggett Group owner Bennett LeBeau. About 300,000 to 700,000 Florida smokers are seeking a multi-billion dollar verdict against the nation's five biggest cigarette makers for decades of industry misconduct in the first smokers' class action case to go to trial. And finally, the U.S. Department of Justice yesterday added a racial profiling complaint to its lawsuit accusing city police officers of civil rights violations. This, according to the Columbus, Ohio City Attorney's Office. The complaint says from 94 to 99, blacks in Columbus were almost three times as likely as whites to be the subject of traffic stops in which one or more tickets were issued. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Elian Gonzalez returned home to Cuba yesterday after the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal of the distant Miami relatives. Juan Miguel Gonzalez, his wife, and Elian and his stepbrother headed for Dulles Airport outside Washington, D.C. This is the last public statement Juan Miguel Gonzalez made before he boarded his plane.
Quiero agradecer al pueblo norteamericano.
I would like to thank the North American people for the support they have given us and to the U.S. government. I think that this has allowed me to meet very beautiful and intelligent people in this country, and I hope that in the future this same friendship and this same impression that I have of the U.S. people, that the same thing can become true between both our countries, Cuba and the U.S. I am very grateful for the support I have received. I am extremely happy of being able to go back to my homeland, and I don't have words, really, to express what I feel.
We are happy to go home. Juan Miguel's last public statement before he and his family boarded the plane to Cuba. Juan Miguel held Elian in his arms at the doorway of the plane. The two waved, and Juan Miguel held up a clenched fist and then entered the plane. At the airport in Havana, family members, including Elian's four grandparents, hundreds of his schoolmates from their hometown of Cardenas, and a senior Cuban official, Ricardo Alarcón, welcomed Elian and his family. We first go down to Havana right now to Jorge Miares, who is a reporter for Radio Havana Cuba's news broadcast heard throughout North America. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, can you describe the scene yesterday in Havana at the airport and what's happened to Elian since?
Well, actually, once that news was spread that the Supreme Court was not going to give any injunction and that Elian would be able to return, it was felt, excitement was on the air everywhere in Havana and specifically and in Cuba in general. People were calling each other, people were just hugging each other. There was a very festive mood. And by the time that Cuban television began to broadcast, it just went to broadcast CNN footage while your description at the time that Juan Miguel's took the plane with Eliane and all that, people were really all over that. But you could see that people were so much paying attention to what was happening in Washington at the airport. At here in Havana at the time of their arrival, it was very moving. That is the word. At the time that Juan Miguel just carried Eliane and came down from the plane, and all his grandparents, his great grandmother, and it was very, very moving. And also to see all his Alianza schoolmates from Cardenas, at the time that they saw the plane, they were really very, very exciting. They were waving their flags, and it was a very, very special moment. We Cubans were looking forward for this special occasion. And there was no official reception or mass mobilization to greet the arrival of Eliane. But on the other hand, we were extremely happy with this victory once that justice prevailed.
Can you tell us where Eliane has gone to live right now?
Well, once that Eliane arrived, his... he and his parents, Juan Miguel, and some of the schoolmates that were with him in Washington, they went to a special complex in the Havana neighborhood of Miramar, where he is going to spend something like 2 or 3 weeks. It is said that he has already learned how to read and write, being a first grader, but nonetheless, his school wants to make sure that he has all the proper knowledges, and from there he will be able to take a vacation along with his with Juan Miguel and his stepmother. And after that, they will go back to Cardenas, and for we and his family hope to be living a normal life.
We're talking to Jorge Miades, a reporter for Radio Havana, Cuba. He is now in this halfway house in Miramar, which is a wealthy section of Havana. Do you think that he will live in Cardenas?
Yes, definitely. Everything is ready for him to return with his family to Cardenas and to return to his school in Cardenas. That's for sure. This is just a moment of transition where he will be spending some time with his teacher and with his immediate family. And everything has been set for their return to Cardenas within 2 or 3 weeks. That's something that has been said here all over in the media here in Havana.
Jorge Miares, thank you very much for being with us from Radio Havana, Cuba. We're also joined on the telephone by Wayne Smith, a former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana, Cuba. House Republican leaders agreed this week to allow the sale of U.S.-grown food and medicines to Cuba, but the proposal is not being praised by opponents of the four-decade U.S. blockade on the island nation. Under the language, U.S. producers can sell food and drugs to Cuba, as well as Iran, Libya, North Korea, and Sudan. It's set to be effective beginning this fall. At the insistence of Cuban-American lawmakers, U.S. farmers and drug manufacturers cannot use U.S. government or private bank credit to finance such sales, and U.S. banks will be forbidden from processing transactions. Cuba would continue to be prohibited from bartering with U.S. companies. The agreement was forged by a bargaining team representing House GOP leaders and Cuban-American House members. The proposal is largely the result of farm state lawmakers who fought for 3 years to open up new markets in Cuba. It also has significant backing of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. As part of the proposal, current U.S. rules on travel by Americans to Cuba would be written into law, making it harder to change them. The legislation would also deny access to the U.S. market for exports from Cuba. The deal is set to be slipped into a conference committee proceeding that would not allow for any debate. The proposal could be put to a vote this week in both chambers of Congress and sent to the White House. Backers said they expect President Clinton to sign it. Wayne Smith, first, what is the connection between, and is there one, Eliane Gonzalez and this bill?
Well, look, I think a number of things came together. The farmers of the United States began pressing for this some 2 years ago. They need markets. They want to sell to Cuba. They realize that that's not going to be the solution to the farm crisis, but it could help somewhat. Then the Elian case. The hardline leaders of the Cuban-American community badly overplayed their hand. They alienated American public opinion, and I think many Americans began to look at our Cuban policy and to ask themselves if it was not indeed obsolete and counterproductive, and to ask, are these the people, as they looked at the flag burnings and defiance of the law in Miami, are these the people who have been so heavily influencing our policy? Well, no wonder it's askew. So it led to public opinion swinging in favor of some review of policy, and that encouraged congressmen to move ahead. I would add, however, that this amendment that has been put forward, while it is symbolically important, it's the first small breach in the embargo, the first small modification in many years, it's a badly flawed document. It really, if interpreted strictly, it doesn't permit sales at all. And even if sales were possible, there's no financing. There's no, not even private banks can finance. And the codification of travel controls, I see, is utterly unacceptable. If I were President Clinton, if that part, if that language is in, which takes away his authority to add new categories of people to travel, I wouldn't sign it because it does infringe upon presidential authority to conduct foreign policy.
How did this all come about? I mean, you've been deeply involved with Cuba policy for 40 years, Wayne Smith. You were the first, well, we wouldn't say U.S. ambassador to Cuba because of the embargo against Cuba, but head of the what they call the U.S. interest section in Cuba.
Euphemism. Let me add that the U.S. interest section does everything that an embassy would do except fly the flag and call a chief ambassador. But I'm happy to report he gets an ambassador's salary, and between the title and the salary, I'll take the salary. No, look, this came about because of the pressures for a change. Representative Nethercutt of Washington is a staunch Republican, but he represents agricultural interest in his district. And so he pressed for this change. But as the way these things go in Congress, as you begin maneuvering behind closed doors and making compromises and adding language that possibly no one understands until it's too late, these qualifications, these reservations were added. What's happened to the travel controls is that the Cuban-American representatives in Congress and representatives pressured by the Cuban-American community, of course, don't want any more people traveling to Cuba, because the more Americans who travel to Cuba and see Cuban reality with their own eyes, the more the pressures for a change in U.S. policy. Not that Cuba is a paradise by any means. There are all sorts of things we would disagree with, the things we would want to see changed. We would like to see Cuba move toward a more open society. Of course, all that. But Cuban reality is not as it is portrayed by these fanatics in the Cuban-American community. I was listening to some of them last night, Congresswoman Ileana Ross and so forth, describing Cuba. They haven't been there in 35 years. They have no idea what Cuba is like today. Tens of thousands of Americans have now traveled, and they don't buy that vision anymore. So this, the Cuban-Americans, again, have pressured members of Congress to do what they want, to represent them. I think it's time that Americans began to ask, do these people represent us? Do they represent the American public as a whole? Do they represent us in a given congressional district? Or do they represent this small little group in Miami?
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Wayne Smith, former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we'll hear from Professor Manning Marable, who spoke at the Green Party convention this past weekend. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Ralph Nader made his first appearance as the Green Party's presidential nominee earlier this week in Los Angeles. Surrounded by children from a housing project, he blasted major party candidates George Bush and Al Gore for ignoring the growth in child poverty amid the booming economy. He accused politicians of failing to use the benefits of a growing economy to invest in programs for children, spending it instead on corporate welfare, such as corporate tax cuts and subsidies. This past weekend, Democracy Now! Was in Denver for the Green Party convention, where a number of people spoke. Among the most fiery speeches was given by Manning Marable. He's a professor of history and political science at Columbia University and the director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies there. He's an advisor to members of the Congressional Black Caucus and is a leader of the Black Radical Congress. This is the speech he gave.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Sisters and brothers of the Green Party, the great political challenge for the 21st century is the construction of a culture of human rights in the United States, the construction of a civil society that preserves individual rights but also protects those who are the most vulnerable. Children, seniors, the poor, and the unemployed. The construction of a humane society that defends both the principles of freedom and equality. A just society that seeks the realization of human fairness and the dismantling of social institutions and policies that perpetuate discrimination and oppression based on race, or gender, or sexual orientation, or physical disability, or immigrant status. The Green Party can help to facilitate a national conversation moving us toward a culture of human rights, but only if we have the courage of our convictions, and only if we are willing to speak truth to power. And so today, my sisters and brothers, let us speak truth to power. More than ever before, the vast majority of America's people, working class folk, members of trade unions, racial minorities, women, people on fixed incomes, the unemployed and the homeless, are being left behind economically and politically. We must redefine America's democratic project to make certain that the whole spectrum of cultures, classes, and communities, groups classified or identified by gender, race, or sexual orientation, that we all have a voice, that we all have a place at the national table. I'd like to concentrate this afternoon on several critical issues for the Green Party and for this country. First, American democracy is challenged by a series of crises that affect virtually everyone in this audience today. They are the crisis of racial inequality or structural racism, the crisis of economic inequality the rapidly growing stratification or division between the wealthy versus the rest of us, and the rapid expansion of the working poor, people who have low-paying jobs or who are struggling just to survive. There is a crisis of incarceration, the unprecedented growth of a prison industrial complex. And fourth, the crisis of public education, with millions of our children falling further behind due to the deliberate underfunding of public education. All of these issues, the crises of race, of class, of prisons and schools, are all interconnected. You can't address any one of those issues without also connecting it to the others. In other words, there's no solution. There's no way to stem the growing numbers of poor people who land up in prison unless we also talk about what's happening in the dismantling of public education. You can't have a racially fair or just society when you're building 100 new prison cells a day in the United States. The task of the Green Party, the task of progressive folk, the task of the struggle for popular democracy in America is for us to make the connections in order for us to pull down the pillars of oppression. Second, I want to talk this afternoon about the positive steps that we can take toward transforming this society. Now, conservatives in both of the major corporate-dominated parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they will tell the American people that the crises that I've just outlined are caused simply by a lack of morality. I'm going to argue this afternoon that values are indeed important, that principles do matter in the articulation of politics. But what values do we uphold? What principles do we fight for and share? Whose side are we on in the crises that I've just outlined in American democracy? Should we learn more from those at the top of the society, or should we study and listen to those who are at the bottom of the society? In the words of the great civil rights activist and theorist Ella Baker, what we need in this country is not leader-centered groups. We need group-centered leaders. What we need in this country, what we need in this country is not democracy from the top down, it's democracy from the bottom up. And finally, there is a matter of vision. Without a vision, the people perish. How do we construct a common language? How do we create a common vision of humanity that can redefine the boundaries of political possibility? What does the Green Party bring to the long and difficult struggle to make and expand and enrich our understanding of democracy? What is the nature of the political struggle which the American people are facing as we stand at the beginning of the 21st century? The central issue that defines American society and politics for our time is the conflict between what could be termed the public versus the private. Can the people utilize the government as a means of addressing our basic social, economic, educational, environmental problems? Or should we emphasize solely market-based initiatives, the corporate sector, to resolve issues like unemployment or poverty or education or housing? Nearly every significant policy debate in the United States in the last 20 years has really boiled down to one single question: should the people's interests or should the corporate interests be most important in our nation? That's the debate we have to raise in this country. The list of the struggle between the people's interests versus the corporate interests is virtually endless. In health care, President Clinton's 1994 proposal for managed health care tried to combine limited government mandates with privately run health provider corporations. So instead of pushing vigorously for the single-payer comprehensive national health care system that millions of Americans desperately want and need. Clinton capitulated to private sector interests, and the whole thing failed. In public education, there's debate throughout the country on the issue of vouchers, whether parents should be subsidized to send their children to private schools. In public colleges, cutbacks in state and local funding have forced higher tuitions and fees, reducing the access of many racial minorities and working and poor folk to a quality education. In the areas of public housing and homelessness, state and city governments are aggressively cutting back funds. Increasingly, Republican and Democratic conservative politicians argue that the government should no longer even be in the business of public housing, that the market, that the corporations should determine the quality and the accessibility of housing. This debate also focuses on the criminal justice system. We are now spending $35,000 a year to maintain a single prisoner, one prisoner, in a minimum security jail cell. It costs nearly $80,000 a year to confine a prisoner in a maximum security jail cell. We are, as I said before, building over 100 new prison cells a day in the United States. In 1980, there were 500,000 people in U.S. prisons and jails. Today, it is 2 million. What does the Green Party have to say? What do we have to say about the struggle between the corporate interests and the people's interests? What are the struggles for human rights that should inform and inspire the Green Party and progressive politics in our nation today? Well, there is a struggle, a continuing struggle, of the well-to-do haves against the millions of have-nots who are disproportionately African-American, Latino, American Indian, women, and children. 4 decades ago, Michael Harrington's brilliant book, The Other America, documented the bitter realities of poverty and hunger in the United States. And despite the current economic expansion, despite the billions and billions of dollars, of millions of profits generated on Wall Street, millions on Martin Luther King Jr. Street, millions on Cesar Chavez Street, millions even on Main Street are being bypassed by that prosperity. The other America still exists. Where is that other America? America's working people are largely today divided into two groups. One upper tier that receives salaries that can only barely support a family, and a second tier that can be described as the working poor. These are full-time workers or people actively seeking work who nevertheless are trapped near poverty. It is that group, more than any other, that was most seriously threatened by the reactionary politics of the Welfare Act of 1996. It is that struggling working families that were targeted for virtual destruction by the Republicans' contract on America. The working poor remain largely hidden in this country, obscured from the light of an honest analysis by racist and sexist stereotypes about who is poor and who is unemployed and who is in public housing. The Green Party has to speak truth to power about the connection between race and gender and class and poverty in this country. In truth, the majority of American workers who earn more than the minimum wage, but less than $30,000 a year, are not black, they are not Latino, they are white. Most poor children live in working families. In fact, only one-third of all poor children live in families depending solely on public assistance. Always keep in mind that millions of Americans who live in public housing and millions of Americans who depend on food stamps are not African American. They are not Latino, they are white. My point is that we fall into a dangerous trap when we racialize poverty. My point is that progressives often fail to make the point that ultimately hunger is colorblind, and that in a racist society, because of racism, that poverty and unemployment are handed out in a racialized way. But for us to transcend the politics of division, we have to find the common ground. What is the challenge of the Green Party? And how do we make the connections? The only long-term solution to the crisis of the working poor is to fight for a comprehensive agenda for jobs and justice. Politically, we must support massive public works legislation where millions of working people can be hired to provide services and rebuild our cities. We should be training people to provide childcare to working parents, health care, supportive services for seniors, improving our schools, and making our communities safer and drug-free. We should outlaw workfare and replace it with real jobs at living wages that can support families. We need to cut corporate welfare. We need to cut corporate welfare and tax abatements. The Green Party's support for economic justice, for community-based economics, and against the exploitation of labor move us in the right direction. But as long as trade unionists, working poor, people on public assistance are forced to compete against each other, nothing will ever change. The Green Party must say we must redefine the rules of the economic game. We must assert every person's right to a job or a guaranteed income, a living wage, especially for those who cannot work. The solution to the crisis of the working poor is the pursuit for the fight for jobs and justice for every person in America. The crisis of race and class that we see in the United States gets played out in part because of the growing economic stratification in this country. In the year 2000, the top 1% of all households had a greater combined net wealth than the bottom 90% of all U.S. households. In short, a very small number of households in the United States control the overwhelming majority of the nation's resources. And you can see this inequality played out in virtually every city and town in the United States. Between 1973 to 1989, the overall annual average of all wage earners living in cities in the United States fell by a real 16%, inflation adjusted. In Manhattan, where I live, the poorest one-fifth of the population in 1990 earned an average annual income of $5,237. The richest one-fifth earned an average income of $110,100 annually. In individual neighborhoods, less than 10 city blocks apart, the vast income gap between affluence and poverty can only be described as obscene. In East Harlem, in a Puerto Rican, in a Latino neighborhood, the average annual family income in 1990, in one census tract, was $6,019. 20 blocks away on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, in one census tract, the average income for affluent families in 1990 was $301,000. In other words, for every dollar that an affluent household in Manhattan has, the poor have 2 cents. These grim statistics reflect a draconian yet strategic decision made by America's corporate and political elite to redirect billions of dollars away from human needs spending, from health care, from public transportation, for job training programs, from public housing, toward the construction of a prison industrial complex that is today in our country destroying millions of people's lives. The clearest way for us to show this and to document this is pointing to the contradiction between incarceration versus education.
Manning Marable, professor of history and political science at Columbia University, speaking at the Green Party convention this past weekend. We'll continue with this speech when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the speech of Professor Manning Marable, professor of history and political science and head of the director. He's director of Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University, speaking at the Green Party convention this past weekend.
A recent study produced by the Correctional Association of New York and the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute, illustrates that in New York State, hundreds of millions of dollars have been stolen from the public university budget and reallocated toward prison construction. The report states that since fiscal year 1988 to fiscal year 1998, New York's public universities saw their operating budgets plummet by 29%, while funding for prisons rose 76%. In actual dollars, there has been nearly a one-to-one trade-off, with the Department of Corrections in New York State receiving $761 million increase during that 10-year period, while state funding for New York City and state university systems declined by $615 million. The basic impact on Black and Latino young women and men in New York State is that it is simultaneously much more easy to go to prison and much more difficult to attend college. There are more Blacks, 34,800. There are more Latinos, 22,400. Locked up in prison than there are attending the State University of New York. This pattern of schools versus prisons in New York exists in virtually every state in this country. Thousands of Latino and Black young adults in California are denied access to state universities because of the passage of Proposition 209, destroying affirmative action. Thousands more have been driven out, and due to slowly increasing costs, rapidly increasing costs for tuition and cutbacks in student loans. Meanwhile, hundreds of millions of dollars have been siphoned from the state's education budget and spent on building prisons. So in 1977, California had 19,600 people in its state prisons. By 1997, it had 160,000 people in prison. California today has the largest single prison system in the industrialized world, holding more inmates in jails and prisons than do France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands combined. Combined. And these trends and these future trends are worse. The California Department of Corrections estimated that it will need to spend $6.1 billion in the next 10 years just to maintain its present prison system. With the exception of General Motors, there are more employees at work in the prison industry than any Fortune 500 corporation. So instead of funding teachers, we are hiring more prison guards. Instead of building new classrooms, we are constructing more jails. One of the central battlegrounds for democracy in the United States in the 21st century will be the effort to halt the dismantling of public education and public institutions in general for the expansion of this prison industrial complex. The Green Party's support for alternative sentencing for nonviolent offenders, for restoring voting rights to American citizens who have been convicted of felonies and then disfranchised in the country of their birth. The Green Party's support for an end to the widespread practice of racial profiling by not just the NYPD and the LAPD, but police departments across this country, that will advance the cause of racial justice. In electoral politics, the Green Party and other progressives must again make the connections by understanding why it is that the vast majority of Americans have such little faith or credibility in the American political process. People ask, why don't Americans vote? The simple answer is that the politicians we have to choose from seem completely disconnected from the real concerns and problems of our daily lives. Can anyone really conceive of Al Gore in the waiting room of a public hospital with a sick child? Can anyone really imagine George W. Bush paying for his groceries with food stamps or living in public housing? We'd like him there. We would like him there, but we can't imagine that right now. A Green Party and progressive perspective must make the connections to the American people between money and the politics and power. Those in power keep their power by plowing money into the presidential, the congressional, and statewide electoral races. With billions of dollars in unregulated soft money contributions, you don't get a Democratic government. You only get the best Congress that money can buy. Our entire political system is held hostage to corporate power. And there's only one solution. There's only one solution. Build a mass democratic movement to drive big money out of the electoral process once and for all. We need to democratize the electoral rules of the game to permit alternative voices and perspectives at the ballot box. Move away from winner-take-all elections to proportional representation. Make voter registration easier and accessible to all. The Green Party's vision of bottom-up democracy represents a real break from the top-down, corporate-dominated politics of the Republicans and the Democrats. The Green Party stand for an open government, opposing efforts to restrict access to public information. It stand in favor of free broadcast time for qualified candidates. Its advocacy of campaign finance reform offers a bold, common sense alternative for a democratic America. The Green Party's 2000 platform and resolutions that I've seen offer a bold leadership on the issue of globalization. They support equitable, democratic, ecologically sustainable economics rather than corporate capitalism. It sensibly opposes nuclear power and the commodification of nature. It calls for democratically based mechanisms to deal with biotechnology while preserving biodiversity, indigenous rights, and food safety. But to win this fight, to win the fight around issues of environmental justice, to win the fight around racial justice, to win the fight against corporate power and for economic justice, means that we must cultivate the capacity to win the minds and the hearts of millions of people in order for us to finally take collective action to achieve our collective interests. Building a successful political alternative to globalized capitalism will take even more than that. It will mean the construction of a new political language and methods of organization to reach constituencies fragmented by gender, class, race, nationality, and language. It will demand that well-meaning white liberals will have to learn from and acknowledge the central roles of people of color in the struggles for democracy in this country. It will require building close cooperation with faith-based institutions, women's organizations, lesbian and gay organizations, organizations of low-income people, trade unions, and youth organizations in order to build a broad-based democratic mass movement for racial and economic and environmental justice. That's our task in the next 21st century. We must fight with a vision and a commitment to racial and social justice. Radicals sometimes think that as conditions worsen, oppressed people will become more desperate and will begin to demand basic change. That viewpoint is completely wrong. History shows that the capacity for resistance is always enhanced by the winning of small victories. To achieve real change, we must win over those with whom we share common interests, but who do not now believe in what we believe. This should not be considered a matter of political conversion or ideologically coercing people into submission, but by persuading them through our work and activities that meaningful, democratic, progressive change is possible. Small victories do matter. And when combined with a broad but radical social vision, the Green Party has the capacity, the Green Party has the energy, the Green Party clearly has the program to help lead in this struggle for justice. Let me conclude with one final observation. Oppressed people never struggle solely to realize abstract ideas. They struggle to improve their children's lives and their own lives within the real world here and now. What most exploited people want most are the tools to make meaningful changes in their environment and immediate circumstances. The developing struggle against corporate power, against globalization, must be informed by an overarching social vision of the realization of human rights, anchored in our analysis of the actual conditions confronting oppressed people in the third world and poor communities across the globe in order for us to achieve democratic change. Now, the Green Party in 2000 may not, perhaps may not, capture the White House. We may not, perhaps not, capture Capitol Hill. Stay with me for a second. We may not capture Capitol Hill in 2000, but by building this party, you build a small victory and a vision of the kind of democracy the American people desperately want and need. By building this party, you can help make the connections across the boundaries of race and class and sexuality and gender. By building this party, you can create an alternative vision of democratic, humanistic politics. You must never abandon the moral discourse to the far right. We must ask the kinds of hard moral questions that the Republicans and Democrats refuse to ask. We might ask the American people, What was more immoral, Clinton's sexual misconduct in the White House or his decision to sign the 1996 Welfare Act that pushed millions of women and children into poverty? I know I've got to end, but I got to ask you one more question. What was more immoral? George W. Bush's decision this week to send an innocent man to his death or Al Gore's failure to denounce it? We must. And I will close with this saying. One of my favorite quotations is from Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin used to say, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice." The moral arc is long. It's very, very long, but it bends toward justice. How does the Green Party, how do progressives in this country, how do progressive folk who are struggling for freedom and democracy and racial and social justice throughout the world, how do we bend that moral arc of the universe toward justice? We bend it toward justice by celebrating our passionate discontent with the way things are. Contented people rarely want things to change too much. If you want to find out how do we bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice, we should never wallow in the mainstream. We need to stand at the edge. We need to stand at the boundaries. We need to learn from those who have little or nothing to lose. We need to understand and feel the anxiety of 44 million Americans today who lack any medical insurance. We need to spend time working in a homeless shelter. We need to walk a picket line with trade unionists. To bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice means to be passionate in our discontent with the way things are. It is to challenge conformity. It is to push the boundaries of the way things are to the way things should be. The Green Party can push the boundaries of the way things are to the way things should be. We can bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice only if we are willing to speak truth to power, only if we're willing to make the connections, and only if we are willing to struggle, because without struggle, there can never be any progress. And as we struggle, and as we have faith, and as we have commitments that transcend the boundaries of division, then we shall create that just society. We can create a new democracy. We can create genuine freedom and equality for all Americans, only if we have a commitment to fight, and we will win. Thank you.
Professor Manning Marable, director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University, speaking this weekend at the Green Party Convention in Denver. He's also a leader of the Black Radical Congress. If you'd like to get an audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Special thanks to Robert Knight and David Barsami on Alternative Radio. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!